What's up, Wisconsin? I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Network. Happy Wednesday, everybody. Did you know that if you have a smart speaker at home, you can tell your enabled device, play WAUK or your local civic media station, and you will hear one of our local civic media radio stations? It's pretty cool. I checked it out the other day, and lots of fun using the smart speaker. Also, are you aware that Civic Media's got music station lineups? If you are looking for 80s, 90s, you can open up the Civic Media app and search for 105.7 CFW in Eau Claire or 99.7 Max FM out of Baraboo and Wisconsin Dells. But if you enjoy country music more, we've got that too at 98Q Country Park Falls, 105.5 WIRI Wisconsin Rapids, the RCO Richland Center, or 95.7 St. Croix Country. All this, of course, free on the Civic Media app from your favorite app store. Just search for Civic Media. Got a fun show today. I'm always excited when former congressional candidate and small business owner Tom Paulsiewicz comes around. We're going to be talking to Tom P. at the top of the 3 o'clock hour about money and politics, maybe a little Paul Manafort discussion, you know, those sorts of things. You're going to want to stick around for that. But I wanted to pick up today with some of what we were talking about yesterday. One of the particular things that I have been concerned about, as I was in 2016, is what happens to our federal courts if Donald Trump wins a second term. And if you will remember, back in 2016, the Federalist Society put out basically its wish list of federal appointees if Trump were to get elected. He basically took that as his own and ran with it. One can point to the Dobbs decision as a result of that, striking down Roe v. Wade. We can point to striking down affirmative action as well as a result of Trump's electoral victory. But of course, it's really worse than that. I've talked about it on my show at length, that this Supreme Court wields more power than any Supreme Court has ever wielded in our country's history and has done so completely unchecked by Congress. So when we think about what a second Trump term could mean, to me, one of the most important lenses through which to see that is what happens to the federal courts. Now, again, I think regardless of whether or not you tend to lean more Republican or more Democratic or you're an independent, we want courts to be very fair, to not be engaging in politics. That judges, of course, were appointed by Republicans may tend to be more conservative, appointed by Democrats a little bit more liberal, but that judges will follow the law. That as a result, because they will follow the law and respect court precedents, you, absent some other crazy set of facts, would expect courts to move in an incremental way. We would also expect, again, that courts really wouldn't be moving to take away rights or freedoms, to reduce equal protection under the law. That, again, we would expect that judges and justices of the Supreme Court would treat similar fact patterns and questions similarly. But what we've been finding is that with Trump's incredible remaking of the federal judiciary at all levels, not just the Supreme Court, that is less and less the case. That courts are more and more extreme in their decisions, that there's less respect for stare decisis, which is the fancy Latin term for adhering to prior court precedent or rulings. In other words, the court's responsibility to be consistent, to treat similar cases similarly. Now, I started yesterday to tell you a little bit about the most recent wish list for Trump's second presidency, should he be elected this fall, that was just put out by the Center for Judicial Renewal, which, again, is this legal arm of the American Family Association. What I didn't get to yesterday was, I first need to tell you, well, what experts did the Center for Judicial Renewal engage to come up with this wish list of judges? It's pretty interesting. Here are some of those constitutional conservative leaders that the Center for Judicial Renewal used to come up with this federal judge appointment wish list for Trump 2.0. It includes Governor Mike Huckabee. One would think you probably want lawyers helping select preferred judges. Yeah, Huckabee's not a lawyer. Next up, Tim Wildman, not a lawyer. Tony Perkins, not a lawyer. Michelle Bachmann, she actually has a law degree, but if that name might ring a bell, she's a bit of a Looney Tune. Walter Wildman, not a lawyer. Frank Gaffney, not a lawyer, but a noted anti-Muslim conspiracy theorist. So they got that going for him. And basically many others who really don't have any legal chops at all. This is who the Center for Legal Renewal or Judicial Renewal used to make their wish list. Doesn't bode well. And indeed, the short list of judges that they give the thumbs up to is pretty alarming. I noted yesterday, James Ho, the infamous author of the enhanced interrogation memo. That guy, he now sits on the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. Lawrence Van Dyke. He's another one on the short list for the Center for Judicial Renewal. This is the guy that the ABA called utterly unqualified for judicial office, who's been characterized as being arrogant, lazy, an ideologue, and lacking in knowledge. But even more interestingly, Van Dyke is also infamous for literally calling his colleagues on the court criminals. This happened recently. In a grandstanding, I think is the only word that you could use for it, a grandstanding dissent that he wrote, ripping, again, his colleagues on the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in a case involving gun regulation that came out of the state of California. Now, what was interesting about this is that one of his fellow judges had just about enough of the, let me see here, arrogant, lazy, ideologue, and lacking in knowledge of the day-to-day practice, including procedural rules, Judge Van Dyke. One of his colleagues had had just about enough after being called a criminal, by Judge Van Dyke in this opinion. Now, I'll set aside for the moment that language like that amongst federal appeals court judges is unheard of, truly unprecedented. There's a Latin term for this. They call them ad hominem attacks. It just means personal attacks. Judges don't engage in this kind of thing, but good old Van Dyke did. In the dissent, Van Dyke took time to cite the James Madison quote about judges not being angels and then used that as a springboard to declare the majority opinion and the majority judges who wrote that opinion, quote unquote, possessed. What? So not only criminals, they're possessed by some demonic force. This is ridiculous. So in response to all of this, Judge Andrew Hurwitz wrote a concurrence where he called out his colleague for engaging in this sort of behavior. He said this, quote, "I join Judge Graber's opinion for the court unreservedly. I would ordinarily not say more, but I am reluctantly compelled to respond to the dissent of my brother Judge Van Dyke, who contends that the majority of our court distrusts gun owners and thinks the Second Amendment is a vestigial organ of their living constitution. That language is no more appropriate and no more founded in fact than would be a statement by the majority that today's dissenters are willing to rewrite the Constitution because of their personal infatuation with firearms. Our colleagues on both sides of this issue deserve better." Let me translate. That's really nice judge speak for shut up. In other words, your argument is dumb, you're engaging in personal attacks, and you need to stop. Judge Hurwitz continued his critique of his colleague, Judge Van Dyke. Quote, "I recognize the colorful language captures the attention of pundits and partisans, and there's nothing wrong with using hyperbole to make a point, but my colleague has no basis for attacking the personal motives of his sisters and brothers on this court. His contention that prior decisions of this circuit involving different laws decided by different panels somehow demonstrate the personal motives of today's majority fails to withstand even a cursory analysis. Indeed, members of the court not among today's dissenters have firearms in their homes themselves. Members of this court, not among today's dissenters, have volunteered for service in the active military or the National Guard and bore arms during that service. It's kind of remarkable that a fellow judge felt the need to go to this length to call out basically completely unfounded personal attacks from one of his, as he puts it, brother judges. Now, here's what Van Dyke, this is the utterly unqualified, arrogant, lazy, doesn't know anything about actual legal proceedings, that Trump appointee judge. This is what Van Dyke wrote in his dissent, which is really interesting about the actual question in this case. He wrote this: "It's telling that comparisons between the First and Second Amendment in this latest case have been largely dropped by the majority and relegated to concurring opinions, likely because it gets embarrassing and wearisome to constantly rationalize why we treat the Second Amendment so differently than its close constitutional neighbor." Well, Judge Van Dyke, that might be because the First Amendment literally includes the words, "make no law abridging." In other words, the government shouldn't abridge free speech. And the Second Amendment actually qualifies the right to bear arms based on a state's right to organize a militia. Because back in the good old days, you know, if you were reading it textually as it was originally written, as all conservatives claim to do, the entire point of the Second Amendment was to permit individuals who join militias to bring their own arms because most states didn't arm their militias for them. It was bring your own gun to work day if you're in a state militia, hence the Second Amendment. They're not treated the same, the First and the Second Amendment, because the language is, of course, different. I'll share with you after these quick messages a couple of these other, you know, bright shining legal stars that's on the wish list for Donald Trump's 2.0 administration. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Network. We'll be back in just a moment. Keep on running, cause the winner don't quit on themselves. Hey, need said, and still there never seems to be a single penny left for me. That's too bad. Well, welcome back, Wisconsin. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Network. I'm talking about what the federal judiciary might look if the MAGA president is elected again. I don't know about you. I'm a little scared. You want to join our conversation? Ask me some questions. 855-75-CIVIC, 855-752-4842. This all got ticked off for me or put onto my radar because this organization came out with its own preferred list of judicial nominees, which includes some doozies. Yesterday, we talked about Stuart Kyle Duncan. I mean, point of fact, anybody that goes by three names, like Stuart, Kyle, Duncan, I'm going to be a little worried about. The three names are never really a good idea. It sort of indicates, I don't know, a bit of prep school. Reminiscent of Judge, now Justice Kavanaugh, talking about squee. I like beer. Okay, I've digressed. Stuart, Kyle, Duncan. Yeah, this is the guy that basically told Stanford law students they stunk. Next up, one of the other notable mentions on the wish list for Trump federal judge appointees is a lady by the name of Kristen Wagoner. She works for the Alliance Defending Freedom. You may be thinking to yourself, I've heard of this before. Don't get it confused with the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League. That's an actual legit organization. No. The ADF, this may be familiar to you because Speaker Mike Johnson used to work for the ADF as well. Now, the ADF, interesting to note, has been listed by the Southern Poverty Law Center as a hate group. Here's some of the things that the ADF supports: criminalizing, for the second time, again, recriminalizing sexual acts between LGBTQ adults in the United States. Oh, and abroad. They include that. That's a bonus. And abroad. They have defended state-sanctioned sterilization of transgendered people. I'm going to say that one again. The ADF, of which Kristen Wagoner, potential Trump federal judge, lifetime appointee, yeah, the organization that she works for has defended state-sanctioned sterilization of transgender people. The ADF also contends that LGBTQ people are more likely to engage in pedophilia, something that is not true. And they've claimed that the, quote, homosexual agenda will destroy Christianity in society. Of course, they're also big fans of state legislation that allows businesses to decline goods or services to LGBTQ people on the basis of their religion. You know, that's somebody I definitely want on the federal courts. You know, fair-minded, definitely believes in the idea that we all should be treated equally under the law, except if you're part of the LGBTQ community. Here's another notable mention. Mark Martin. Who's this guy? He may ring a bell. He used to be on the North Carolina Supreme Court. He's now become the dean of the High Point University Law School. Now, if you're thinking to yourself, I've never heard of High Point University Law School. Yeah, that's because it didn't exist until this year. So that's cool. But his name may be actually familiar to you because, you know, he was knee deep in January 6th, coming out of the January 6th committee reports in a section about how Trump was refusing to concede the election lost during his speech on January 6th. There's this line. Mark Martin advised President Trump that Vice President Pence possessed the constitutional authority to impede the electoral count. Of course, that's not true. But that's Mark Martin. So an insurrectionist made the list. I talked about Morris Tan yesterday. Of course, he equates the Holocaust and abortion. So that's lovely. We've got Judge Lisa Branch. She's one of these judges that has decided that they're not going to hire law clerks from places like Yale and Columbia to make a point. Now, the decision of a whole bunch of federal judges to decide not to hire law clerks from Columbia has gotten even more pointed. A bunch of them signed a letter to the dean of Columbia Law School. And what's really interesting about this is they don't just express that they're not going to hire anyone from Columbia Law School, which would seem to lump in a whole lot of people and into just one group and treat them, you know, I'm not going to hire any of them regardless of their merit or their work or their legal acumen. A little ridiculous. But it doesn't just say that. The letter goes so far as to demand that Columbia engage and take certain positions about some of the ongoing student protests related to Gaza. Here's what the letter says. Again, this Judge Lisa Branch on the shortlist for a Trump appointment to the Supreme Court signed this letter to Columbia. Here's what they ask for. Serious consequences for students and faculty who have participated in campus disruptions and violated established rules concerning the use of university facilities and public spaces and threats against fellow members of the university community. I have two things to say about this. There are photographs and evidence that some of the protesters have engaged in outright anti-Semitism. I don't know what percentage. I would like to believe that it is a very small minority of the protesters, but that's happening. That creates an extraordinarily hostile environment for students of Jewish descent. It shouldn't be permitted. But what I hope is the vast majority of protesters have been peaceful, not engaging in anti-Semitism or hate speech towards Jewish people. And this demand misses the whole point of what civil disobedience is. Civil disobedience means breaking the rules and sometimes breaking the law. That's the disobedience part. The idea is to do it peacefully, civilly. But the idea, the purpose of protests is to create pressure to try to advocate for certain changes. By its very definition, that will include some rule and law breaking. The simplest idea of that is trespassing or staying overnight, etc. I mean, what the heck do we think the sit-ins were in the 1960s? They were breaking the rules. Secondly, the judges ask for, quote, neutrality and non-discrimination. Now, while that sounds fine on its face, let's read. It has become clear that Columbia applies double standards when it comes to free speech and student misconduct. If Columbia had been faced with a campus uprising of religious conservatives, upset because they view abortion as a tragic genocide, there it is again, the analogy of abortion and genocide. The letter continues, we have no doubt that the university's response would have been profoundly different. Here's what I find interesting about this. When white nationalists marched on the University of Virginia's campus, chanting, Jews will not replace us, the school did basically nothing. Where were these judges then? Nowhere. Didn't have a thing to say about that. Seems that they're a bit situational. I'm going to come back after your farm update. I'm going to continue with this hit list and remind us of the stakes, not just for Dobbs and women's freedom to choose healthcare, but for a whole large swath of other issues. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Network. We'll be back after your farm update. Welcome back, Wisconsin. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Network. Talking this hour about what we might anticipate in terms of quality of judicial appointees and their views on the world if Trump is elected again. I was talking a bit about Judge Lisa Branch, who signed on to a letter to Columbia Law School telling them that they won't be hiring any more law clerks from Columbia. But they went further than that. And the big finale of that letter was this demand. Number 3, viewpoint diversity on the faculty and across the administration, including the admissions office. Yeah, there it is, ain't it? Now, just think about these demands that these folks sent to Columbia University. These are federal judges. They don't have anything to do with how law schools run themselves or their admissions process or who they select for faculty. At least they shouldn't. And of course, they sort of truss it all up as if they're dispensing some kind of legal advice. But this isn't about their interpretation of what's good free speech. Except apparently when they think it's going to politically benefit them. It's just ridiculous. It is such an incredible, vast overreach for federal judges to try to dictate to any school this sort of ideological preference. It just is. And it's an abuse of the public trust. But that's, you know, the sort of judicial appointee that we can likely expect from a second Donald Trump term. If you want to join our conversation this hour, 855-75-CIVIC, 855-752-4842. Hey, Dave, how you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good.
Yeah, they're using state power to suppress free speech, and that's wrong. I do got to say, though, it has crossed my mind that they are calling for a boycott also of my alma mater, where, you know, people have all kinds of differing views, and their view, they don't want to be, they don't want their views suppressed either. If you don't want to be boycotted by these people, though, they say you gotta sign something that says, you know, Israel should be destroyed, that you're against Zionism. Anyway, I called up about the other issue, though, and that's judicial appointments and the right-wing trend of our judicial system. You know, Nixon's four appointees, Trump's three, the fact that no modern president appoints liberals to the court anymore. They do appoint moderates, but we haven't had a Marshall and Brennan for decades and decades, has really caused problems on the court. You know, and the court is not, the judiciary is not a co-equal branch. It is the branch that controls really everything. All power since those three events I've mentioned have flowed from the Supreme Court. Let me give you examples. Arrogating power to themselves over regulatory matters. They overturned the Voting Rights Act, or the preclearance provisions anyway. Of course, voter suppression, campaign finance laws. This is bribes, you know, money's changing hands. Gerrymandered. And, you know, in 2000, they even overturned a presidential election by contradicting their own, what they said was their deeply held states' rights jurisprudence. And they also said in the opinion, by the way, this is sui generis. There's no presidential value. Now, I don't see in my lifetime how Trump gets elected, and or if a Democrat gets elected, that's going to be changed at all. I think maybe it's too late. Tell me the difference really between, you know, the membership is still the same, the Standing Committee of the Politburo in China, or the Faqih in Iran, and the billionaire Ayatollahs. No, don't laugh. I'm serious about this. What is the difference? They have absolute power. They cannot be appealed from. And they know this, and so they're destroying. They've already destroyed our democracy. Anyway, go ahead.
Dave, thanks so much for your call. And as usual, you're right on point. Just in case folks didn't know, sui generis means that they treated the case as of its own type, that it doesn't stand precedentially for anything else, just a category of one. Dave's point, though I was chuckling, it was the sad, rueful laugh of someone who agrees that we're in a very dark time when it comes to the federal judiciary, especially the Supreme Court. Again, as Dave noted ably, they have more power now than they've ever had in the history of our nation. They wield it without any accountability as lifetime appointees. They flout openly ethics rules. They decide elections. They will grant king-like immunity to a president, all without recourse from the people. But there is recourse, and it's through the ballot box. Now, Dave's right that even Democrats aren't really appointing liberals anymore. They're appointing moderates, but I'll take a moderate any day to some of the yahoos that are being proposed for potential nominations to the Supreme Court should Trump be reelected. It scares the bejiggers out of me. And in case we've all forgotten, let's take a listen, shall we, Calvin? We're going to take cuts one and two right in a row, Calvin. This is April 12th, a press conference that Donald Trump held at Mar-a-Lago when, you know, good old Speaker Mike Johnson came down for a visit. Let's take a listen.
Because we don't need it any longer, because we broke Roe v. Wade and we did something that nobody thought was possible. We gave it back to the states.
Many people have asked me what my position is on abortion and abortion rights, especially since I was proudly the person responsible for the ending of something that all legal scholars, both sides, wanted and in fact demanded be ended, Roe v. Wade.
Not this legal scholar. I mean, it's just observably baloney. But the important part is he promised to end Roe v. Wade, and he stacked the court with judges that did just that for the first time in our nation's history, regardless of your personal, moral, or religious viewpoints about abortion. For the first time in our nation's history, a court decision took a freedom, took a right away from one group based on their membership of a gender classification. First time that someone was taken, that a right was taken away from someone. Truly shocking. But as Dave mentioned, and thanks again, Dave, keep listening, keep calling. Perhaps most disturbingly is this trend with these extraordinarily far, far right judges that are being selected by these far, far right fringe groups that don't represent the majority of Americans or are the values that the vast majority of us share. That's what's worrisome to me. Why is the Federalist Society defining the federal judiciary? They don't represent me. They don't likely represent you. It's a fringe group of elites from Ivy League universities. Why is the Alliance for Judicial Renewal, which has a very Christian nationalist bend, why are they picking our judges? It's totally anti-democratic. And again, these categories of cases, we are seeing the courts again and again trend towards fewer rights for the individual, fewer freedoms for the individual, especially if you've belonged to groups who historically have not been treated equally under the law. So fewer freedoms for those folks, fewer freedoms for the voter, fewer protections for the voter and the citizen, and a greater expansion of both the judicial branch's power, but also the executive branch's power. We see this in the erosion of the Voting Rights Act, as Dave mentioned. But there's two cases that I love to use to point out the utter nonsense that we see coming from the federal courts, courtesy of Trump 1.0. There are two cases that by any measure involved very fundamentally similar questions. And yet the decision by the Supreme Court, stacked illegitimately by Donald Trump, came to two totally different decisions. The only commonality, the only common thread between the cases is that each outcome decided by the Trump-packed, illegitimate, fringe-right Supreme Court acted effectively to oppress or take away rights, to lessen equality under the law, to take away the average person's ability to, frankly, get ahead in this country. The common thread is the cruelty. The two cases I'm referring to are Trump v. Hawaii and Biden v. Nebraska. Just to refresh our collective recollections. Trump v. Hawaii, yeah, that's the Supreme Court case that decided that Trump's Muslim ban, the second version, was perfectly constitutional. And of course, the court tortured itself and turned itself into knots, the majority did, in the Trump v. Hawaii case, by making sure to say that the Korematsu decision, which upheld Japanese internment camps, Japanese concentration camps. Korematsu was terribly decided. But in her dissent in Trump versus Hawaii, Justice Sotomayor said this: the majority decision redeploys the same dangerous logic underlying Korematsu and merely replaces one gravely wrong decision with another. Yeah. So I'm going to call it Korematsu 2.0. The trial court, in considering Trump's Muslim ban 2.0, said this: when considered along the constitutional injuries and harms discussed above, the questionable evidence supporting the government's national security motivations, the balance of equities, and public interests justify granting the plaintiffs nationwide relief. Of the order's neutrality to religion, which is what Trump's government claimed. Well, we don't actually say it's a Muslim ban. We just ban people from certain countries and make it really hard for them to get in. This is what the district court said. The idea that courts can't look past the literal words of an executive order to the overall political context and the things that were said surrounding that order is ludicrous. The notion that one can demonstrate animus toward any group of people only by targeting all of them at once is fundamentally flawed. It is a discriminatory purpose that matters no matter how inefficient the execution. Equally flawed is the notion that the executive order cannot be found to have targeted Islam because it applies to all individuals in the six referenced countries. It is undisputed that these six countries have overwhelmingly Muslim populations that range from 90 to 99%. I mean, you know, literal religious discrimination because the executive branch of government wanted to do it. That's fine for the Supreme Court. But in Biden versus Nebraska, in which Nebraska and a group of states challenged Joe Biden's original student loan forgiveness policy, all of a sudden, the same Supreme Court found no need to defer to the executive branch's judgment at all. And here's the language that was fundamentally at issue there, and then I'll go to the phones, 855-752-4842, 855-752-4842. This was the language at issue in Biden versus Nebraska. The executive branch of government has the authority to, quote, waive or modify any statutory or regulatory provision applicable to the student financial assistance programs under Title IV of the Higher Education Act of 1965. Sure seems like a broad grant of authority, the executive branch of government, but not according to this Supreme Court. Religious bans, fine. Helping out students, don't you dare. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Network. We'll be back after these brief messages. Give us a buzz or send us a text, 855-752-4842. Welcome back, Wisconsin. Ben from Eau Claire, call back. We just lost you. I'm Maggie Dawn. We're talking about what the federal judiciary might look like and the sorts of decisions that we could expect if the MAGA president is elected again. I was talking about the Biden versus Nebraska decision as it relates to or can be compared to the Supreme Court's decision in Trump v. Hawaii. In Trump v. Hawaii, yeah, banning people from entering the country based on their religious preferences. That's just fine because the executive branch of government needs to be able to exercise control. But in Biden versus Nebraska, that same Supreme Court, no, the executive branch doesn't have authority, despite the fact that Title IV of the Higher Education Act of 1965 says that the executive branch has the authority to waive or modify any statutory or regulatory provision applicable to the student financial assistance program. Oh, and the legal rationale for that one, I have to share with you. What the neoconservatives and Christian nationalists on the Supreme Court and elsewhere in the federal judiciary call the major question doctrine, which basically says, yes, we'll let the executive branch of government make rules and decide how to implement the laws as they should do, except where we decide it's a really big deal, in which case we, the court, without having any relevant subject matter expertise, will just decide what the rules are, you know, when it's a big deal. Yeah, that's the major question doctrine. We're going to go to the phones. You want to join us, 855-752-4842. Ben from Eau Claire, you're on the air.
Hey, Maggie, just a couple of quick points. I agree with you on the Supreme Court and the lifelong tenures that these people have. You know, I think the biggest issue, I take a little bit of issue with you saying that the court is illegitimately stacked towards the Republicans, you know, with Trump, because I think one of the biggest miscalculations the Democrats made was thinking that Hillary Clinton was going to get elected. You know, RGB was getting pretty old, pretty up there, and I think that the Democrats rolled the dice and thought that Hillary was going to get elected and she was going to get the next picks, and they left RGB in there when she could have easily retired and given that pick to the Democrats, and she she didn't do that. So I think that was a miscalculation on their part there. I'd love to see a constitutional amendment. You know, we have an amendment that says that presidents can't be elected younger than 35. I think there should be an amendment that no senator, no Supreme Court justice, and no president could be elected after the age of 70. Certainly a...
Yeah, I think, Ben, there's all sorts of interesting things in there. And your point's well taken as to the miscalculation by Democrats related to the 2016 election. I say that the court's illegitimate and stacked largely for two reasons. First, Obama's appointment of Merrick Garland was illegitimately robbed from him after Justice Scalia died. That had never happened before, where a nominee was simply never granted a hearing. That was illegitimate. It was a flouting of all norms that had existed prior to that time. The second reason I say it is that when you look at the nine justices of the Supreme Court, six are very arch-conservative Republicans that hold views that do not reflect the values and opinions of a majority of Americans. And those six were appointed from four Republican administrations. There's only three Democratic appointees on the Supreme Court, and that came out of five Democratic administrations. So the ratio is 2-1 in favor of these arch conservative MAGA justices who, again, came from four Republican administrations, and there's just three Democratic appointments from five Democratic administrations. Thanks, Ben. I appreciate your call. Dick from Madison, thanks for being patient. You're on the air.
Maggie, you know lots of judges, you know lots of probably states, attorney generals. This intellectual orange giant with that stupid blubbering that you just played, I don't think that any attorney general or any judges at the state level are clamoring to have this on their plate. Correct me if I'm wrong. I think it's the last thing they want to do. It's just amazing the stuff that this guy will steal.
And by this, Dick, what do you mean? When you say AGs don't want to have this on their plate, what specifically do you mean, Dick?
I mean these decisions on Roe v. Wade, you know, at the state level. Yes. It's going to go to judges at the state level and attorney generals, and I don't think there's many of them, even in red states. Look at Kansas, how they voted 2 years ago, or it'll be 2 years this summer.
Yep.
There was a red state that said no. And this guy comes out and makes this ridiculous. No one ever challenges the guy either.
Yeah, I hear you, Dick, and I share your frustration. Thanks for listening and calling. One of the shocking things I saw on a headline today was that like 17% of Americans attribute the overturning of Roe v. Wade to Joe Biden. What? No, that was all Donald Trump. All Donald Trump. And Dick's point is especially well taken. Not just do I think that attorneys general don't want to have anything to do with this hot potato. It's absolutely absurdist. Do we need a green book for women to know what states are safe for us to pass through? Do we have to plan our vacations and our road trips with our families according to what states actually treat us as full and equal citizens, full participants in the social and economic fabric of this country? I mean that with all sincerity. We need a green book, a pink book for women now in the United States. That's not the way freedoms and rights are supposed to be governed under our system of laws. A texter texted in and asked me to talk briefly about Leonard Leo. If you don't know who this guy is, he's basically the architect of these judicial wish lists coming from the Federalist Society. He's co-chairman currently of the Federalist Society's board of directors. This is a rich guy with extraordinary influence. He basically architected Clarence Thomas's confirmation procedures, or hearings, I should say, and he supported the confirmation processes of John Roberts, Sam Alito, Neil Gorsuch, Brett Kavanaugh, and Amy Coney Barrett. And in case you're keeping track, Leonard Leo basically handpicked all six sitting neoconservative MAGA justices on the Supreme Court. That's Leonard Leo. Should our rights be determined by one rich guy? I don't think so. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Network. Don't go anywhere. We're going to come back after news, weather, and sports with Tom Paulsiewicz. We're going to talk about money and politics.